This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
We're now going to have a bit of a panel discussion. You'll see three new faces on the panel, one of whom stood up from the floor and made a contribution this morning. So what I think we're going to just slightly shift the focus from communications with students and staff, just to go slightly wider and look at the general impacts of the whole merger process on students, staff, and wider stakeholders. And I'll ask all of our three participants just let us know who they are and make a few opening comments and observations, first of all, so that we can put their participation in context. And first of all, on your extreme left, Janice Shiner. Janice, could you just give us a brief 2 or 3 minutes, please, of your observations and where you stand?
Thank you very much. I thought because I was here I would go last, so thank you. I'm going first. You also told me I ought to say who I am. So, and one of the problems I always have when I sit here and say, well, who I am, it's always about who I used to be. And but now I'm director of WCL, and somebody asked me over lunch, what does WCL stand for? And it stands for White's Consultancy Limited, a small consultancy firm working across government for the last 8 or 9 years, really involved in change, project management. But in the last year, really taking those lessons learned into the FE sector around innovative models of delivery that, to be honest, are about being short of merger and actually not thinking about merger as the outcome. I wanted to say something that actually wasn't just about merger, because I think the issue around merger actually is clearer. It's quite clear that it's going to impact on students, and it's quite clear that it's going to impact on staff and without doubt, and clearly on stakeholders. I think it's when you talk about outsourcing and you talk about shared services that I want to take a slightly different stance, really, and just say, to start by saying, and they are very different. I think the approach that you would take to shared services is a very different approach to what you would take to outsourcing. And I think there's some danger of using them in the same sentence and assuming that they're the same. And when I look at merger, in many ways, merger is easier. It takes longer, it costs more, but there's a process to it. And there's lots of good practice and best practice around that we've just heard from David. Actually, when you look at outsourcing and shared services, there's not very much of it. There's not very much of it in FE. There's not very much of it in HE. There's not very much of it in health, in police authority. There's some, but actually we find it incredibly difficult. And why do we find it difficult? I think we find it difficult because actually we often make an emotional judgment about whether we want to do it before we've actually worked out what the benefits might be. So we start to think about shared services, or indeed about outsourcing some of our provision. And I would tend to see outsourcing as more about sort of volume transaction, where shared services might be about quality, effectiveness, maybe efficiency too. But actually, it's difficult. And actually, as we start to work towards it, because we're testing and trying it and wondering whether we should do it, often we pull back. And that's been our experience over the last year, that people can see the efficiencies, the numbers on the page, and that number might be less because of the VAT issue, but you can still see the numbers. But actually, it's too difficult. And it's because people, I think, don't make that commitment to it up front about why they're doing it. My view is that if you want to cut costs, maybe that's not the way to do it. I think you need to look at whether you can cut costs in other ways, because I think actually shared services is about effectiveness, and it's about a better service for students and for your stakeholders. So maybe a bit controversial, but actually I don't think it's got anything to do with students and stakeholders in some ways, because if you're going to provide a better service, do they care who's delivering your HR? Do they care who's paying your staff, who are the staff employer? Actually, they really care that you're getting a better service. I think you might want to ask them about what a better service might look like, but I think in terms of the wiring, I'm not really sure that actually the impact on staff and students, or staff I'll put to one side, staff significant impact, but students and stakeholders. So I'll throw that out for discussion. I think we see three key things being talked about, really. One is about culture and about change management. I sometimes think culture is another word for control. I don't want to let go. We know that with change management, unless there's a burning platform and people recognize it and it's getting hot actually they'll look for other alternative ways of doing it. And then you've got to believe that now is the time to move because that platform is getting really hot. So you've got to have a burning platform and you've got to realise that now's the time to make it happen. And then people have got to understand where you're trying to get to, and then they need to believe in the journey that you're going to take to get there. Classic change management stuff, really. But I think it often that comes later and not early on, and also the whole culture issue gets in the way, I think, about, you know, we don't want others to do this, often because it's a competitor who might be providing, but often we don't want to do it because we don't want to let go. There's a lovely little anecdote about Whitehall that a few years ago was told that it had to share services. There wasn't a choice about it. Every government department had to share services of some sort. They were given three choices. They could go with someone else, they could do it themselves, or they could stay where they are. What did they all choose to do? Oh, they could outsource it further out to someone else. So they could go with another government department, they could provide for other government departments, or they could take it to an outsourced company. Every one of them said they would do it for other people. Really interesting. And I think these are some of the challenges that we're dealing with within FE. There are solutions, but they're about being really clear up front about why you're doing it. Is it to cut funds? Is it about cutting costs? Is it actually about a better service? And is this the answer to both of those, or indeed neither of those? And I think to have that clarity at the beginning and to have worked through how you're going to deal with the vested interests. We talk about, and you know it's a cliche, isn't it, but turkeys don't vote for Christmas, so you need someone who is holding on to that belief that actually this is a good idea. Because our experience of working with over 50 colleges over the last year is that it's very, very difficult and emotionally quite hard to, I think, to pick up David's point about if you want to get staff buy-in, really hard for staff to buy in to something which actually is going to mean less jobs. So I think there's a, you know, I would put merger to one side. I've done mergers. I've seen them happen over many years. I think they're relatively more straightforward, expensive, time-consuming, and all the rest of it. Actually, I think this is a more difficult process because of that need to be very clear up front about why you're doing this. And we'll say more about this in the session that we're running after this. Thank you.
Thank you, Janice, very much. Moving one seat towards me is Dan Talbin.
Dan Talbin, I'm Senior National Education Official at UCU. Before that, it was NAPFIN. Of course, UCU is a merged organisation, and if you want to have a contrast in cultures, then look at NAPFI and the Association of University Teachers. There was a clash of cultures, if ever there was. So we've been a merged organisation for the last 6 years, and we still don't have... We're still working on harmonisation of policies between the two respective parts, still 6 years on. So we're not an absolutely great model. But I didn't prepare a presentation, and what I'm going to say is some thoughts on what I've heard today. And it seems to me, underpinning all what we've heard today, where mergers, partnerships have been successful, and David referred to it a lot, I think it's about clear and transparent communications. FE staff, lecturers and support staff have felt, well, from before 1993 and incorporation, that things happen to them, things get done to them, and that's what they don't like, so I think involvement is very important. We are embarked on what I see as some massive gambles. We seem to have abandoned 14 to 19 policies in favour of 14 to 16 and 16 to 19. We're embarked on a major gamble around eligibility, who's eligible for free provision, student loans for provision over level three. And I think we have not yet experience what the changes in HE will do to young people and parents' behaviour. I think all that is in the melting pot. It's not helped by, frankly, I think, a slightly contradictory positions from SFA and BIS. I mean, we have Jeff Russell, the new hard man of FE, going around saying there's going to be a lot less FE colleges, and I suspect he's right. But then BIS emphasised now localism, mergers seem to be off. We have some, UCU is not opposed to mergers. We have some red circles. as we say in trade union circles, chief of which is no loss of provision on the street. That's what matters to us, student provision on the street, and along with that, obviously, our members' jobs. And I think the other principle is around collegiality. My colleague John Offord, who's sitting in the audience, spent many years working for NUS, and at one of the periodic reviews of FE governance came up with an excellent paper, which we'll both send to you if you're interested, around a model that he'd taken from the then NHS model around stakeholder governance. I'm sure we are not yet done with changes in governance. I fully expect we're going to have a review of the instruments and articles of governance in the last couple of years. I think the difficulties around mergers, and I'm talking about mergers rather than partnerships, clearly 2P and transfer of employees. I can't but think that this government is going to have a pop at 2P in the not too distant future. I think they've even signalled that. Harmonisation of contracts. I mean, Barnfield's very interesting, but I just wonder how they do manage to, or even whether they even attempt to harmonise contracts between all their different bits. Governance, certainly NAPFI and now UCU have been very concerned ever since incorporation about the democratic deficit in further education that is actually not accountable really to the communities that it purports to serve. We have looked at the Welsh example and we haven't actually rejected that two-tier model of governance, but what we want to see is much stronger links between that wider membership body and the board of directors. I think different inspection regimes will be a problem. I was at Ofsted last week along with the other teacher unions, and I raised the problem because we were talking about the new inspection framework for schools, about, well, if colleges were taking over schools and sponsoring academies, what inspection framework were they going to have? Was it schools? Was it FE? What about HE in FE? I was told, oh no, there would only be one inspection framework. Well, I'll believe it when I see it. Professionalism. At the moment, as you all know, we are stuck into an almighty dispute with the Institute for Learning, which may or may not be resolved shortly. But, I mean, in the Barnfield example or the Salford example, taking over two sixth form colleges, there's a completely confused picture of whether sixth form college lecturers join GTC in the year it's got left or join IFL. I don't know what the answer is. And then we've got distance management has been raised. Well, we've certainly had problems with distance management, for instance, in prison education. And it looks as though, from the latest review, that BIS has some too, because it looks as though it's moving away from that model of one or two large providers being much more clusters of local providers. But then we've got DWP provision, which is mega contracts, and there's subcontracting down. And, I mean, I've been around long enough to remember franchising and all the scandals about franchising. Will those develop again with minimum contract levels? And I'll finish on that I've been around long enough that I've seen them rise and be lauded. I remember Bilston, Holton, Wirral Met, the most wonderful colleges imaginable in the mid-90s. Some don't exist, and some went through very, very troubled patches. So everybody and everything has its day, but those days tend to be relatively short in FE.
Thank you very much, Dan. And finally, Paul. Paul, a few tidbits of what you've noticed and observed so far today.
For those old enough, you'll know that KPMG is also merged. You probably know it's Pete Marwick. We've added Kleinfeld and Girdler at the end. So there is that commonality of theme amongst us. I also thought I was sitting next to Brian Inglis because of all our yesterdays and where we'd been with Hilton and whatever. Hilton and whatever, until I realised I'd been working there as well. So FE for a long time and seen mega changes. The last 3-4 years, I've been heavily involved in the FE provider market. My underlying motive and theme is about performance improvement. I see about 150 colleges in terms of principal leadership a year, with a growing pro bono SASE market on governance meetings, which seem to have really gone like topsy. but they do reflect governors' increasing awareness and concern about the variety of things that are going on out there and how they want to be kept up to speed. If we take performance improvement as a theme, I don't think the key question is about should we do mergers or should we do federal structures or whatever. I think the key question is what structure will work for us to get the job done quickly enough. There's 22 mergers I've been involved in that we've successfully completed. The 23rd will finish in 2 weeks' time. And the timescale for those have varied between 10 months and 28 months. And 28 months is clearly unsatisfactory if we really genuinely believe on the ground that the learner benefit is the motive for these changes. So taking the title literally about impact on staff, learners and other stakeholders, there can be as many and as varied as each local context would generate, with personality differences, is it a rescue merger, etc., which clearly isn't now. So I'd just like to leave you with 10 bullet points that I think are key determinants about the impact that you see on whichever organisational structure it is that brings about performance improvement. So it could be merger, it could be federation, it could be collaboration. And based on all of those I've seen, particularly in the last 3 or 4 years, I would offer you these 10. The first is the motive, which is underpinning the partnership. And there have been some fairly negative motives, like will I get a package if we join now? Values that are underpinning the partnership. Your localism, your learner first, your strong local partnerships, business efficiency and commercial drive within it. The third one, and I think the equal most important one, is the quality of the leadership and management. And to be asked 4 months into a merger, what exactly is a merger, and do you think we've got what it takes to drive it forward? If a principal and senior team have to ask that question, assume it's rhetorical and assume the answer is negative. Timescale management. I know we're doing a merger or a collab, but we've got the day job to do. For senior strategic leaders, that is the day job. Do it effectively, do it efficiently, do it quickly, so you can get your message in place. So your timescale management, very important. Fifth, and I think David and others made this very clear, it's your internal communication strategy. If it's not there, you leave holes, and into holes develop rumours. And while some rumours can be very useful, some can become deal breakers. So your internal communication strategy is absolutely crucial. Then you've got your harmonisation strategy. Otherwise, the turkeys really do believe that Christmas is on the way, because I don't see, as Dan outlined in some of the points, where is that harmonisation taking place? Why will I work for something which might hurt me personally, my mortgage and my family? And these are questions that do have to be taken into account, because people do worry, and I've seen the impact of those where they haven't bothered with an effective internal communication strategy or a harmonisation strategy. The other thing, relative position of the partners at the start of a collaboration or federation or merger. Very, very important. I remember doing one merger where a principal said, you will have 2 governors, we'll have 18, quote, you're bloody lucky, we're even bothering about you. Hardly the basis for a partnership. Yeah, let's be very clear, this is a takeover. If you weren't so crap, it might be better than that. And the daft thing is, they've merged. The degree of commercial realism and awareness. Because if we're looking at performance improvement, if we're looking at efficiency savings, then as long as we reinvest them back in, whether it's a cooperative model or whatever, for the benefits of the learners, then we should be chasing the efficiency. Janice was outlining questions to ask about which type of model you go for delivery. But underpinning whatever model you go for is the efficiency. We've just done 21 colleges in accelerating college efficiency model. We've found £30 million of bog standard inefficiency lying there just waiting to be identified. There's still plenty we can do in the sector to raise that. The intensity of the learner focus, very, very important, and the vision for the learner. They are our customers. What we're doing is upgrading the range, the quality of what it is we're offering them. And that, with your leadership and management, is the equal most important strand. The final two, the quality of the external stakeholder relationship, and finally, the quality of governance and degree of involvement. One principal said to me, I'm going to make every paper to the governance, the governing bodies on this merger, a minimum of 4 pages long. Quote, that will confuse them, I should get no trouble from them. I think the model is for the governance to actually work with you as the critical friend and use their expertise as well. So They are the factors that I have found that influence the impact on the stakeholders that we identify. And I just want to share that with you.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Paul. Let's try now and to get as much exchange of views in the room from and between the panel and the floor as possible. The microphone's in the room again, so please, at any stage, please just indicate with a hand if you've got a question or an observation to make. And sir, just remind us who you are again. We heard from you this morning. Thank you.
John Offord, UCU, and as Dan pointed out, I used to work for NUS as well. It's a question directed to David, really. You mentioned staff, you mentioned students. You didn't mention staff unions and you didn't mention student unions. And the governing body is actually legally responsible for the strategic direction of the institution it's taking and for its mission, vision and values. Now, there's a congeries of factors there that are ideal for communication, aren't there? And you're also required to engage with Learner Voice. I negotiated that with Bill Rammell as well. And the LSN made you a document, which was based on what I wrote. So I think you missed a few tricks with the communication, really. And speaking as a policy officer who works nationally for UCU, I would be a little bit worried if I didn't hear more about curriculum and private provider. I'd want to know absolutely what you were up to on that one.
David?
Well, we do meet with the unions, and to be honest, I take the whole staff group as my litmus test. That's not to say our trade union colleagues, both in UCU and Unison and Co, are out of the loop. But in a way, we've dealt with it in a slightly different fashion, and you may feel it's a mistrick, but we try to hit all of the staff body in one go. Clearly, for those union reps that have particular questions, we have the usual and traditional forums to do it, and we've always been open about how we try and triangulate the message because of the two institutions involved. But, maybe for some institutions where it's maybe less representative or whatever, different ways of dealing with the problem. But we don't exclude them, and we'll make that point. I mean, they're part and parcel of it, but I tend to use the holistic approach when I'm dealing with the message around these significant options.
Could the question of curriculum private providers was also just mentioned in the question. Can you give us a flavour of how that's being approached?
Yeah, I mean, we've been, I can't say who, but I mean, one of the mantras that we've got, and it comes back to the top of the meeting, which is the world is changing rapidly, and what if Company X could deliver the education program that we were delivering and it was good as a partnership or actually better than, would we ignore the option? And the answer, in my view, was no, we can't. And so if we are alive to, and it's a threat and an opportunity, first and foremost, we need to be alive to the threat of commercial partners coming in and delivering curriculum. I mean, you know, you see it from Marks and Spencer apprenticeships and so on and so forth. They're going to get more, I think. There are a lot of other companies that are looking at the apprenticeship and work program route to get involved. Well, we need to be aware of that. And all we've done as Southgate College is try and adopt the risk factor of saying, well, if this happened or is likely to happen, how do we get a slice of that pie? How do we make sure the quality of our teaching and the excellence that we believe we have in a number of areas retains the market share? And so we were up front with staff around, if this does happen, how do we respond? And then as leaders, we've had to try and have that debate around looking at sensitivities, looking at opportunities, looking at the things that could come in and left field us and maybe take the market away from us. So that's how we've approached the issue of commercial partners and threats and opportunities.
Thank you. Yes, Dan, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to come in. I think the one thing I forgot to say in a rush of trying to get all my points in, I was somewhat concerned this morning when the speaker from Eversheds seemed to say, well, you can do this. This doesn't stop. You aren't stopped by the instrument and articles of government. Our very bottom line, UCU's and I'm sure Unison's, is that further education is a public service. It's a public good. And as somebody said, I think it was the principal from Salford, talked about the college having a history of over 100 years. All our FE colleges, they are community assets, and we will fight to the bitter end to preserve them as community assets. Management holds that community asset in trust, and it needs to be passed on to future generations as a public service.
Thank you. Anybody? Yes, please, Janice.
They are community assets. I don't pull away from that at all, but they're community assets with a job to do. And that job is about providing the very best service they can in terms of that community, however you define it. And I think if we take that to a position which means that we therefore can't do things differently in order to be more effective in a time when, you know, the resources are getting less, then actually I think the idea of a community asset becomes quite empty. So I suppose my challenge is, how do you hold on to that importance of a community asset, but use it in order to deliver the best service you can? And if that means thinking about different delivery models, if that means working in partnership with the private sector, if that means a whole range of other things, we should be open to those.
Yes, Paul, please.
I don't think that either of you are differing from each other. One is saying it's a community asset, and the other is saying, but we must modernise to make sure we deliver that community asset with the appropriate vehicles.
Dan and I never disagree.
all I would like to add to that is that it's only a community asset if it's seen as sufficiently high quality to be wanted by the community.
Okay.
And I did some work when, I think it was John Denham was saying every community should have its college, and my counter was that every community should have a high quality college. And we found in a very short time 6 colleges where more than 60-70% of local full-time FE learners were voting with their feet and going 15-20 miles away. Mm. So we're back again to the key question about what structure will work to ensure that a local community asset remains an asset. And in one sense, you could say we have more choices than we ever had before. You know, as Glyn pointed out with the structures, as you just said, Dan, with the protection of that asset, as you've outlined, Janice, with the different vehicles to deliver that asset. And I think we've got to stay as senior managers on top of what's around there and not walk away and be scared from that range of choices. And I'm sad to say that a number that I'm meeting is saying, yeah, complicated, isn't it? A lot going on, isn't it? Thank God I'm 59. Mm. I think you should celebrate the fact that you're 59 or 60 or 61 with all those years behind you and still the burn to do a very good job for the next X years as pension age moves further away from us.
Thank you. Another contribution from the floor. Gentleman in the shirt, please.
Chris Fabby, Unison. You can get all the union comments out of the way in one go. I mean, our members predominantly work in support staff roles, so we've been used to engaging in these discussions, particularly around outsourcing, for a good number of years. But I think one of the things that sometimes is missed when we're looking at decisions about the most efficient way to deliver a service or to deliver a service with public money is actually that you don't just rush to the market. That one of the things where we come in as a union and as a workforce is that you come to the workforce and say, well, actually, are there ways we can make in-house improvements? Yeah, a procurement policy isn't just about saying, right, we'll outsource. It's about a range of options. And we've got colleagues in local government in Newcastle who engaged with local authority and identified millions of pounds of savings. And actually, it was cheaper to stay in-house and have an in-house improvement plan than go into the market. So I guess it's just a plea to engage us early, not just because you have to, but also because your workforce and the unions will have some expertise, which ultimately can help you save money in the long run.
Thank you. Perhaps those constructive suggestions from your members might not have come about were it not for the, in inverted commas, threat of changes going in the other direction. Who knows whether it takes that environment to produce those sorts of constructive comments. Rhetorical question. Anything else from here? I'd like to go back to the... one more gentleman at the back with the yellow tie. Yes, sir.
Yeah, Colin Riley, Stoke-on-Trent College. We're obviously in a commercial world now, and organisations will not survive unless they produce a surplus, which they can then invest in whichever way they decide to invest. My concern is really, I suppose, to Paul, are the organisations that we have fit for purpose? Are our governance organisations correct? And I think we're putting an awful lot of demands on governors who, at the end of the day, are unpaid. So, and our views of stakeholders, I think, are a bit woolly, really. I think we need some clarity there. I wonder if there's any comments on that.
The comment I would make on governance is that I see it as more enthusiastic, more up-to-date, more critical than 5 years ago. Whether it's completely fit for purpose, I would question because of the pace of change. Now, I would raise the question that in some colleges, which I've seen as financially failing and plateauing rather than going up, quarry is increasingly becoming an issue. So it does raise questions sometimes. Is it too tough? Is it too depressing? I won't bother. And I think that uplift in governor morale and how to do the job fine. I think the issue about paying governors, why not? You know, normally we buy expertise rather than expect enthusiastic people, one of whom I know is the governor at three different colleges and rang me recently and said, can you find a corporation that meets on a Thursday night, because currently I have that one clear. I'm not sure that that is what governance is about. It's about expertise, local enthusiasm, and wanting to make a difference.
Quick comment from Dan, then back to the floor.
Two quick potential solutions. One, make being a college governor part of the public duties for which you get statutory time off for. That might help some of the flow. Second, I think if we want business to be involved in education, full stop, not just colleges, schools, etc., it's about time that we actually offered a bit more of a carrot, and I'd like to see some form of tax credit for businesses' involvement in learning, in education. There's plenty of performance measures you could come up with, number of apprenticeships. Can't remember if business education links still are there or they went, but things like that. Have something, have a bottom line value for IIP.
Thank you. Yes, another question, sir.
Hello, I'm David Wood at Lancaster and Morecambe College. The biggest threat to my college is the politicians and the fools who run some of the departments, the ideas they come up with. And I think maybe this debate and discussion we've got here, it has been created by Jeff and co around mergers and things like that. But it strikes me, if you pitched it, that how can we support individual colleges to improve their efficiency and the performance, we wouldn't be sitting here having such a polarised debate. I'm at Lancaster and Morecambe. I've got 11 to 18 schools within 3 miles of me, two universities, and an adult college within 3 miles of me. I have got very little space to manoeuvre, and yet we make a profit each year. We've been very efficient over the last 8 years. And I guess the point I'm making is there is a place for individual colleges, and I think the discussion ought to feature on how you can support individual colleges, improve their efficiency in really quite challenging times, as opposed to saying, well, get into bed with somebody you haven't known and you don't really want to know in the next 15 months. So there is an issue, I think, here about how we pitch the opportunity. And I think there's lots of us here in really good colleges thinking, do we really have to do this and why? Thank you.
Thank you. Janice, perhaps that echoes a part of your message.
I think it does. Thank you. I mean, I suppose my message was, look at your own institution before you start rushing out and trying to find somebody to get into bed with. And that was my point, I think, that we've only had one answer for the last however many years, and it's been called merger. And I think, you know, we have a minister that doesn't particularly like them for reasons that I think some of us understand some of it. But actually that is quite a good situation for people to stop and think, well, maybe that's not the answer, and actually maybe I need to look at my own institution and how I can survive and flourish in this new world. And actually, shared services or outsourcing or partnership or whatever you want to call it, it must be in that menu of things that you want to consider. But it's for the right reasons. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, I'd echo that. I think the situation must be that your strategic options review is the key thing, and that's your governing body. I agree that the sort of ministers, the sort of offices that come up with some of the statements are frankly distracting and unhelpful, and that's why we do what we do and carry on in our view in the way that we believe is best for the community, because unfortunately you do get some ministers who really don't see the sort of bigger picture themselves and yet espouse the same old recommendations. So I think the strategic option review, which is good for the community and obviously the college, is a thing that my board bought into. And it considered all of the things that you've been referring to and come up with a particular view. But, yeah, it's got to be about help and support, hasn't it?
Paul, we're up against the wire, but closing comment?
Very briefly, I'd just say that, David, perhaps you'd be encouraged by the fact that this year I've seen more colleges than in previous years actually trying to follow what you recommended, that they look internally at how they make themselves more efficient. Perhaps we could put the challenge to you. Is it, what, a 14 million turnover? You need to share how you get a regular operating surplus and maintain quality. There's a dozen of you at that level across the sector who do well, and there's 258 GFEs. Perhaps we need to share, like we used to, peer success in that way. There are not enough of you yet doing that.
Perhaps that's the next conference. So we're going to break for tea now, and the breakout sessions start in 20 minutes' time. But thank you to our panel for this afternoon's session.